Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, and I'm here to tell you about a really special event coming up in just a few weeks. We're going to have our 100th podcast episode, and we're doing it live, in person, with the studio audience. Everything will be live. We'll even be streaming it on the web live, so you can actually pull it up and listen to it as we do it. Yes, see how many flubs we actually make behind the scenes, and this time you'll get to see it live. That's going to be on November the 28th. Right now it's scheduled for 10:30 in the morning on November the 28th. There'll be more details coming about the website and where you can find it, and you'll be the first to know. So join us on November the 28th as we celebrate our 100th podcast. Thanks in large part to all of you that have been listening. Thanks, and we'll see you on November the 28th.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you took the time to download us and you're taking the time to listen. Every week we strive to bring you the interesting people in sports medicine and health, and today is no exception. We're quite honored to actually have a renowned author with us. Dr. John Fox is with us on the line today. How are you doing today, Dr. Fox?
I'm doing great, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're more than welcome. And tell the audience a little bit about you. Dr. Fox is an anthropologist by training. He has a PhD in anthropology from Harvard University. He taught at both Harvard and Boston University. He has left academia several years ago to do some really interesting kind of outreach things, and hopefully that'll be part of the conversation today. But he's written for magazines such as the Smithsonian, Outside, and Salon. He has appeared on Good Morning America from the top of a Mayan temple, as what I understand. He's appeared on CNN, NPR, CBS, a variety of other places. And he has most recently written a book called The Ball. And it's, we'll let you tell the audience, what is the book The Ball about?
Well, Tim, it's an exploration, as the title kind of conveys. It's about looking at why we play through the lens of this this kind of familiar and yet almost too familiar object, the ball. So it's really a global look that explores the notion of play and explores how we came through time to play the games we play, and particularly how this object, which is really universal across cultures, across centuries and millennia, has been at the center of these games we play. And ultimately, like, why it means so much to us.
Yeah. And I will say for the listeners, this is an incredibly great read. I would really recommend it for everyone to read. Anyone that's interested in sports science or exercise science, the root of what we do is it comes from what John has talked about in his book. And I guess without stealing too much of the thunder from the book, especially the first chapter, tell us why you got interested in this. You're an anthropologist. Usually anthropologists are interested in these kinds of things.
Well, it's really a twofold answer. One is that as an anthropologist, my focus years ago as a graduate student was the ancient Maya of Mesoamerica, Central America, and Mexico. And folks may or may not know that they originated the first competitive ball game in the world, going back to about 1500 BC. My excavations, my research as an anthropologist was focused on that game. And I excavated ball courts in Central America and really dug in pretty deep on that kind of esoteric game that most people have never heard of. But it kind of came full circle because I kind of moved on from that and did a lot of other things and wrote. And the real kind of spur behind this book was my 7-year-old son. And one day we were playing ball and typical kind of father-son scene in the backyard, throwing a baseball back and forth. And he had this kind of existential moment, and he said, hey, why do we play ball anyway? And
kids ask the best questions, don't they?
They do, you know. And it was like, it was kind of a toss-off question, but it was also very profound. And, you know, having the interest I did, I said, well, you know, let me get back to you on that. And I ended up traveling all around the world for a few years before I actually got back to him on it.
Well, and I tell you, for the folks that are listening, if for no other reason, you should read the first chapter of this book, because he follows that question from his son with other typical questions that we won't go into here. But I have to tell you, John, that was a laugh out loud moment for me. I mean, and that's when my administrative assistant said, "Are you okay in there?" And he was like, "This is just hilarious." So the book is written with it's a great study in why we play, but it's also written with a fair bit of humor, which is always making it an enjoyable read for me as well. Now, let's come back to this game that you talked about that was played here in the Americas very early on. I mean, you said you excavated ball courts. What were these, basketball courts, or what kind of ball courts were these, and what kind of game did they play?
Yeah, this is it really is a fantastic story, and I encourage anybody who hasn't been down to the Yucatan in Mexico to go looking for some of these courts. So the ancient people of Mesoamerica, and that's really all of Mexico down to Honduras, over 3,000-year period, played a game called ulama. It's got a few names, but we'll call it ulama, which was most common. And this game was played with a solid rubber ball, almost like a giant super ball, 9 pounds. So
9 pounds.
Yeah,
like a bowling ball.
Exactly, a bowling ball made out of solid rubber. You can imagine the kind of like kinetic energy in that ball.
Wow.
And they played in these quite elaborate masonry ball courts, which had kind of two sloping walls on either side, an alleyway in between where they played, and these large stone rings, usually up about 10 or 12 feet, that they had to knock the ball through in order to score points. And some of the interesting things about this game, one is that it was played with the hip. So they actually padded themselves and had to strike the ball with the hip, which is pretty unusual compared to, I think, just about any other ball game out there. The other thing that was interesting about it is that it was a kind of ritual. It was more than just a game. It was connected to their religion and their ceremonies, and ultimately it involved human sacrifice, which is probably the thing that most people tend to remember about it.
Wow. So losers got killed?
Losers in some of the most ceremonial games got killed. Now, I'm sure, you know, obviously, like any sport, it was played at different levels. You had your kind of sandlot games with kids and, you know, your kind of pickup games with adults. But then when the ruler got involved, when it was played in these grand ceremonial courts, we do have depictions that show that losers were sacrificed and offered to the gods. And it was all part of this really important ceremony. So, you know, one of the messages there is that, you know, sports are more than just games. They are integral to our social and political and religious makeup.
Well, and you also talk in the book about how sport was often, in those days, also used as training for combat, as a pseudo substitute for combat in many situations. And that certainly sounds like what you're just talking about.
Absolutely. So if we look at the other great Native American sport, which is lacrosse, and that's the one that survived and is, in fact, thriving today. You know, it originated on the Great Plains. It was played by the Iroquois and other tribes. And it was called Little Brother of War because it was a kind of proving ground for young men who would ultimately become warriors. So at the one time, it was training for war. And at the other sense, it probably also allowed tribes to avoid war and to create alliances and to arbitrate disputes without loss of life and property. So there is that intimate connection. I think it's still there in a lot of respects between sport and war.
Well, it's interesting as you talk about that. In your book, you talk about several of the chapters deal with the history and the cultural significance of some of the major sports we talk about today, basketball, football, baseball, certainly lacrosse. And it was interesting the take on injuries. If I recall correctly, in the lacrosse chapter, you know, when the topic of injuries came up, it was like, yeah, so what? That's, you know, part of becoming a man. And that was a real early characteristic of football, as there was a lot of concern about the injuries in football. And many people said, well, you know, that's, they're proving themselves to be men, and so that's to be expected. And do you see much of that discussion nowadays when we talk about injuries in football?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's more alive in our culture now than it ever was. Mm. I mean, you know, the truth is football. And, you know, for me, being an anthropologist, when I say football, I go back, you know, about seven centuries, because I'm thinking of the full sweep of the evolution of the game into, you know, soccer, rugby, and American football.
Right.
But it's always had this tension around violence.
Mm.
I mean, in the 14th century in England, one of the earliest versions of football was banned by English kings 9 times because it was, you know, dangerous to people and property. Today, you know, fast forward to American football with the recent concussion crisis and the bounty scandal, you know, with the New Orleans Saints.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to a program the other day that's just about the diminishing number of kids who are choosing to or being allowed to play tackle football.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the reality is the evidence is suggesting that, you know, getting hit in the head repeatedly from the age of 14 or 15 just isn't a good thing for your health.
Right.
So it's something we've grappled with. I think, unfortunately, we love the game of football in part because of the violence, not because we like to see people hurt, but because of the excitement and the sense of living on the edge that that we're drawn to, and at the same time we are appalled by it, and we're always kind of recoiling from it. So it's a really interesting dispute, and I think it'll get hotter before it gets cooler.
Right, and you talked about the version of the earlier versions of football being banned 9 times, and I think you also talked about in the book how tennis was banned as well, but. Mm-hmm. All these games continue to be played in many situations.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things about early games, when we look at the medieval period, tennis, football, bowling even, and other sports like that, they were seen at the time as being frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
They were seen as kind of diversions that weren't really worthy of people's time. And when you look at some of the reasons behind why these games were banned, it's partly in the case of football because of the violence, but more so because the peasants and the commoners were being diverted from what they were supposed to be doing, which was archery, which was kind of mandated by the royalty to defend the kingdom. And instead, they were spending their weekends out kicking balls around and, wasting time. And so there was all this debate back then about, you know, is there any really positive value in these crowds of people going out and spending time knocking balls around in fields or courts? I think we've come around very slowly to the belief that, in fact, you know, sports are, you know, not just good diversions, but they really help build social skills in young people. They make us smarter. They bring us together. They have immense social value, but certainly that wasn't the belief back in medieval times.
Yeah, I think you even speak about in the book about Galen had noted the connection between what we would call exercise now and having sharp mental prowess. So this thought has been around for a while.
Absolutely. Galen, which people probably have never heard of, was a physician, a Roman physician, who was among the first to argue for the need for dissection of animals in order to study them, which was, at the time was forbidden, even though, of course, the Romans didn't mind, you know, tearing people apart in Colosseums and things.
Right.
But they had something against dissection. And he was a smart guy, and he wrote a treatise on the exercise with the ball. And he was writing about a sport called harpastum, which is kind of a early predecessor of soccer and football. And he, you know, in a very modern sense, articulated a lot of the values, physical and social, around playing ball.
Mm-hmm.
And really nobody wrote like that, you know, for another 1,000 years or so until you had James Naismith and others coming around and saying, hey, you know, this is really important for our young people.
Right. And along that line, you touched on it briefly in the book. You really didn't go into it very much, but this desire to play, I mean, people have continued to play even when the games were banned. There's been that connection between play and health. And what does it say about our society when so often now play is being taken out of, especially the public schools and the elementary situations? I know there are many school systems that have reduced or eliminated recess for their kids.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that setting our society up for?
Well, I think it's a huge mistake, and I think we still have this pervasive dichotomy between sports being considered as kind of frivolous and expendable, versus academics, which are essential to our well-being. It's a false dichotomy, and really the most obvious is the fact that you look at obesity in young people. Which is, fairly epidemic. I mean, there are obvious health reasons to get kids outdoors and give them a recess to play and run around. And but even beyond that, I mean, one of the things I found in this book and researching it was the connection between playing and intelligence. Mm. There's been a lot of great studies done with oftentimes with other mammals like dolphins, which I spend time with, even rats, that show that animals that are deprived of play do not develop in the same way. Their brains literally develop differently. They don't develop the same level of social skills, the same kind of cognitive capacities or empathy. Play is not just for our bodies. It actually builds our intelligence. And I think that's where the movement needs to come from, is we need to realize that this is just part of growing up and becoming a complete person. It's not something that's expendable.
And it's not necessarily about structured play.
Exactly.
It's about unstructured play as well.
Which is the other thing. I mean, we're so guilty as grown-ups now of kind of over-structuring and regulating our children's play. I mean, God forbid they should just go out and play a pickup game without, 50 adults standing on the sidelines telling them what to do.
Yeah.
So I think there's a big need to sort of reflect on these things. And, part of what I hope people get from the book is just, thinking about play and thinking about these games in a new way and reclaiming some of that, that thinking and that essence.
Well, and I know from a university standpoint, I've been at several universities, and there's always an effort either to take out the activity courses out of the curriculum or make sure that they stay in the university setting at all, because there's always this movement that says, you don't need play, you don't need recreation, that's not healthy. But, there is, as you say, so much literature that suggests that is not the case, that it is healthy, that we need it as humans.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think of, the interesting things that can be done in a curriculum, not to get off topic, but you have athletes who are exercising, football players, say. There's so much equipment now to monitor their heart rates, what's going on with their bodies. You could easily create a course where athletes are playing and then studying the body and the physical sort of impact of that play almost in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And in one fell swoop, you're merging, physical education and scientific education. And you just need more innovation around that. Instead of thinking of them as like, okay, now we're going to go play, which is something completely different than learning, to think of them all as a form of learning, I think would go a long way.
Yeah. Let's talk about basketball for just a minute. You have a great chapter, a lengthy chapter in your book about basketball that covers, I think, a lot of cultural topics. It covers the introduction of women into the sport, Muslims recently coming into the sport. It really talks about the emergence of the African-American population playing the sport. And I didn't realize, and I've been a basketball player and nut all my life, I didn't realize that in 1939, the first world professional basketball tournament, the two finalists were two African-American teams, one of which was the Wrens and the other one was the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah, that's right. The chapter on basketball surprised me as well. I it's the most recent of our games, or at least our major sports, only invented in the 1890s. And yet the history of it is so interesting, particularly as it relates to the social dimension, to the sort of liberation of women and the kind of bringing race and gender together.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the great early basketball players first were were Jewish because it was an urban game. And, you know, the kids who were growing up playing the game on the streets of New York and Philadelphia and some of these other eastern cities, you know, a lot of them early on were, you know, the children of immigrants, Jewish immigrants. So you had these great, you know, early teams like the Sfas, which are, you know, South Philadelphia Hebrew team. Mm-hmm. And then it went from that to African Americans who, you know, of course were also an urban population and picked up this street game and ran with it. But, you know, they hit a ceiling pretty early on. So you had these great early African American teams who were barnstorming around the country and beating their opponents, but they couldn't stay in a hotel in the town, and they were sleeping in, you know, cow sheds, and you know, were ostracized or kept out of competitive play or denied medals when they won simply because they were black.
Right.
So, you know, just as we saw in baseball with Jackie Robinson, I think sports and basketball in this way provided a sort of acceptable way of African Americans and other minorities breaking in to the culture, breaking in to seize their rights. And there's just so many great stories.
Yeah. And these first two teams that played in the world, it was a true world championship, actually, the New York Renaissance Big Five and the Harlem Globetrotters. What's interesting, as you talk about in your book, is that they really approached the game with different attitudes.
That's right. The Harlem Globetrotters were really, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy around it and debate around it, but the Harlem Globetrotters, much as we think of them today, were performers. Mm-hmm. They came out of this era of, you know, African Americans kind of camping it up for often white audiences, and so lots of tricks and lots of goofing around and that kind of thing, but much less focus on sort of serious basketball. And the Wrens really rejected that. The Wrens wanted to be seen as a basketball team in their own right, you know, that could compete toe-to-toe with any white basketball team. So they, when they faced off, there was a bit of tension around that, you know, which was the right way to go, which was, you know, which was going to be the kind of future for African American basketball. So it's a great tale, really, kind of captures that era.
And we won't tell the audience who won.
No.
We'll let them read the book and figure it out.
Exactly.
Yeah. One other topic I want to touch on here, and I've written a bit about it in some of our blogs. It seems like, With the team sports that we're all involved with, you know, you have a professional championship that happens, and the fans riot, they burn cars, or if your team loses, you're depressed all week. Can you touch on this in the book? Why is that? Why do we identify so much with our teams that they cause us to go through this great emotional upheaval?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I mean, there have been some surveys done in showing that people, in many cases, even in fairly religious areas, identify with their teams more than with their church.
I hadn't heard that. That's good.
Yeah, so it's pretty profound. And you know, I think it goes back. I think it's a pretty deep thing. There's a real tribal connection that we have to our teams, whether it's, you know, our college football team or our hometown baseball team. You know, for me, it's the Sox. This was a really depressing year for me personally because of that.
Yeah.
But I think there's, you know, part of it is we have, as humans, we have this desire to belong and this desire to be part of something bigger than ourselves and even our family, to have a sort of intimate connection with something bigger. Some of us find that, of course, in religion, and some of us find that in sports. And there's a dimension where sports are still these kind of tribal rights. You know, when you think of you know, Ohio football, and you think of, you know, Script Ohio and all of the rituals that go on in teams and the mascots and the special songs that are sung and the special colors and face paint and on and on and on. I mean, these are tribal rights, like any other. You could go to Papua New Guinea and not see anything that interesting. So, I mean, these are, so I think there's something to that, and we get caught up in it. Our identity, is there. And I think the other dimension of it, and I go out on a limb a little bit here, but, you know, I feel there's One of the things that we've done, which I think is a concern, is we've gone from being players to spectators for the most part as a society. We've outsourced play to professionals, and they get paid a lot of money. We watch them every weekend on TV while we sit around and drink beer and eat chips. I think there's part of us that, like when you see some of these riots on the field, I think part of it is we've got this energy where we want to be in the game, and we're not. And the only way for us to be in the game physically is sometimes to act out in really, antisocial ways. So I think one of the things I'd love to see happen more, and it's happening in some places, is for people to just get more back into the idea of play for themselves, by themselves, not outsourcing it, not, even for adults, like don't depend on your kids to, get all your satisfaction around these things. How about, a pickup game or go out and play golf or whatever you do? It's really important for us to just be involved physically ourselves.
Right. You talk about in the book this older game called Kirkwall Baugh that is
wonderful
in the Orkney Islands, where there you have literally hundreds of people on each team, couple teams. Maybe that's a solution, is after a football game, we have the Kirkwall Baugh game out in the parking lot with all the spectators.
I would love that, because it's, the Kirkwall Baugh is really, for me, it was the greatest sporting event I've ever been to, and I've been to a lot. But it only takes place twice a year. It involves pretty much the entire town, so you have about 200 players, pretty much all men, and most of them very large. And they form two teams, not based on choice or money or anything, but based on which side of the town they were born on. So if you're born on this side of town, you're what's called an uppie from the upper side of town. If you're born on the other side, you're a dooney on the downward side of town.
And you became a dooney, right?
I became an honorary dooney. I visited, and because I first set foot out of my rental car on the downward side of town, I was automatically a dooney for the rest of my life, which I'm quite proud of. And we did win that year for the first time in over a decade, so I attribute some of that maybe to my spectating.
Yeah, your presence. There you go.
There you go.
Well, we're running a little short on time. I have just two last questions. You had to travel a lot, and you experienced a lot of different things as you put this book together, which I'm very envious of. That really sounds like a cool thing to do. What was your favorite story of as you prepared this book? Maybe even something or your favorite experience that happened as you were doing the research and pulling this book together.
Wow. Picking a favorite is pretty hard, because I did have some extraordinary experiences, and for me, a lot of my writing is frankly an excuse to get out and meet interesting people in faraway places.
There you go.
But one of them was not that far from home, and that was when I went up to the Onondaga Indian Reservation in upstate New York to cover lacrosse. And, lacrosse is a game I was pretty familiar with it. I didn't play it growing up, but my sons played it, and I love it. I think it's a fantastic game. I knew it was a Native American sport. I knew a little bit about it. But so I went to Onondaga, which is really the heartland of lacrosse. I mean, these are people who invented the game 1,000 years ago and have kind of kept the flame, in a sense. And, when you first go to Onondaga, it's south of Syracuse, a fairly poor area, as many reservations are. They've been hard hit. They once had all these lands, and from failed treaties and so on, it's shrunk down into a fairly small area. There's not much employment. It's a little bit depressed. So on first glance, it was like going into any kind of post-industrial, slightly depressed town. But quickly, I kind of got below the surface, and the sport of lacrosse is really a way that this community comes together. It really is integral to their culture. And their beliefs as Native Americans around the game, which they often refer to as a type of medicine when it's played on certain occasions, are still going strong. It's more than just a game for them. It's such an important part of their culture. And I spent time there with the only remaining stick maker, who literally cuts down hickory trees and fashions them into the most gorgeous wooden lacrosse sticks you've ever seen. He's the only one left. There's a couple of them up there. There's only a couple of them who can still make sticks like that. And watching him do that and the sort of passion and love he puts into it was really an eye-opener. And I drove away from there just really inspired.
Hmm. Great story. We're running a little short on time. Can you give us your take-home message? What is it that you want people to remember from this podcast?
Well,
other than buy my book.
That would be nice. I would definitely appreciate that. But no, I think it kind of, you know, this book goes a long way. It's a big journey through, you know, tens of thousands of years across continents. But, you know, it kind of comes back where it started full circle, which was just playing this game with my son. And it's, you know, my take-home message is really these games are important to us. We have, you know, kind of nurtured them and developed them over thousands of years, and they make us smarter. They bring us together as people. They help us kind of resolve conflicts and negotiate social and racial barriers. They're more than just games, and we need to first acknowledge that and appreciate that, and then think about how do we reclaim these sports so that they have that level of meaning for us in our culture. I think we've strayed a little bit, I think, again, with the professionalization. I think with all of the onslaught of controversy and scandals that we're all sick of, you could pick up a sports page today and there's more in there about business or scandal than there is about actual games.
Yeah.
So I think it's, for me, it's like just think about how you play in your life and create more opportunity for play. And just go out. If you don't have a ball handy, go out and get one and start playing with it, and you will instantly be a kid again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I know I feel that way. So it's kind of like bringing it home, I guess, is my message.
Yeah, great take-home message. And, John, we thank you so much for taking time with us today. And for the listeners, again, John's book is titled The Ball. I would highly recommend it as a read. It's a great read, and you can get it to all the major outlets. It was just released in May, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And, oh, I'd also recommend if you hit his website, and we'll put that link up on the show notes, they've got a trailer there because you're putting together a documentary based on the book, right?
Yeah, that's the next project. It's pretty exciting. We're already shooting. We shot up in Scotland for the Kirkwall Bah, and it'll be a documentary called Bounce, How the Ball Taught the World to Play. And it's based on the book, and we hope it'll be out next fall. So look for that at a theater near you.
Super. When that comes out, can we talk again?
Oh, you know it.
And so, John, thanks again. And I want to thank all of you that are listening again for taking the time. And as we always do, we have got a podcast T-shirt question for everyone. And here's our producer, Kelly, with a question.
Which body part was utilized in the first organized ball game?
Great question. Be the first one to send us the correct answer via email to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll get one of those nifty-looking podcast T-shirts. And once again, John, thank you for taking the time today.
My pleasure, Tim. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had a great time, great conversation. And thank you all again for taking the time to listen. We hope that you download and listen to us next week when we have another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine. Until then, we hope that you stay active and stay healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.